Welcome to the Title League podcast. I'm Kurt.
And I'm Trish.
And today we're joined by Jesse Tipping, the co-founder of the Athlete Institute in Mono, Ontario. And I say Mono because some of us might be very familiar with that location.
Some of us may not be familiar with it whatsoever. But what Jesse's my favorite kind of guest because as well as having a connection to basketball, to Canada basketball, to the NBA that we'll hear more about, he actually has a connection to what has probably become in the last couple of years a true Canadian iconic television series, and that's Schitt's Creek. It took Canada by storm a number of years ago on the CBC and most recently made its way to the US, where they have found an extremely loyal and dedicated fan base. And the connection there is that Jesse actually owns the Rosebud Motel. And we'll get into the story of how that relates to basketball before its life as the home to Schitt's Creek.
Yeah, there's lots to get into with Jesse today. He is definitely, when you think of Canadian influence when it comes to growing the game of basketball, he is definitely at the forefront of that. We'll get into some of the stars that he has been around and some of the stars that he has helped with them getting further in their career. And more importantly, just the entire Rosebud Motel and how that came to be with the show and them cleaning house at the Emmys this year. He's got a very fascinating story because you've got the world of basketball and the world of pop culture colliding, which makes it extra special for Trish so that we can kind of geek out both on the basketball side of things as well as, I guess, would you say the Hollywood side of things?
The Hollywood side of things, the other fun side of things. He's the best kind of guest for our show because he takes the worlds of sports and the worlds of pop culture and collides them effortlessly. So let's get him on the show.
Welcome to the Title League podcast. I'm Kurt.
And I'm Trish.
And today we're joined by co-founder of the Athlete Institute, Jesse Tipping. Jesse, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot for having me.
And for those that may not know, you have got a very, very rich history in the basketball world. You've been able to help grow this country's game. You've also been part of, I guess the easiest way to call it is a lot of media success with Schitt's Creek and the Rosebud Motel. So we'll get into that,
just FYI.
But, as we get started here, where did your basketball journey start? I mean, at what age did basketball become a part of your life?
For me, I really got hit with the love of the game in the ninth grade, so I moved around a lot as a kid going through elementary school. So there was always pieces of sports, but I never really sort of had that, set it. Here's the league, here's the team, and you work your way up from there. So for me, as I found that love going into grade nine, I had more consistency in terms of where we lived and I found a group of people and I really loved the game. And from there was really my exploring how to get better at it and just sort of seeing what pathways were available to someone like myself and other kids that were out there.
And growing up in this country, at a time that you were playing, high school basketball, it still was very uncommon for Canadian high school players to go over to the U.S. and play college basketball. Guys were still trying to figure out that pathway. They were trying to break through. So for you, was Division I, Division II, was that something that was on your horizon? Is it was it a goal, a dream?
Yeah, Division I was always my goal. Everyone has this ticket out there of getting a D1 scholarship. And, when I was trying like everyone else is trying, there's a lot of hopes. It definitely didn't look like the landscape does today, but there's also there wasn't a lot of like, this is the way you do it, this is another success profile that you can see and how to sort of align how do you get there. So the people who were getting those D1 scholarships when I was in high school, sort of end of the 90s, beginning of the 2000s, it was, okay, do you have a mixtape? It's on VHS or DVD at that point. And like, you just try to get it to as many coaches in the States as possible. And, that works for the Denham Browns of the world, right? Who are just that much better than everyone else. But when I was finished sort of, that journey of looking for that, I saw how many you know, athletes were at that level that they just didn't have the support or the pathway to, you know, ensure that they could get there or that they had access to, you know, exposure or anything along those ways to help with that journey. So
it's so
for me, yeah, I wanted to be a D1 athlete and it was try until you fail. And then once that happened, it was okay. How do I make it possible for other people?
You know, it's so funny. I talk about this all the time because I grew up sort of in that cusp of, you know, Google being a thing, but still, you know, there was no social media. It was basically MSN Messenger or ICQ or like, yeah. Like there was, so I have this conversation all the time where it's like, from the negative perspective of social media, you can't just appreciate anything purely anymore. There's always like 100 sides that you see of athletes or celebrities or even in your own persona. But the flip side to that is you have the ability now, or your players have the ability now, to create a platform for themselves and promote themselves in ways that go far beyond a mixtape on a VHS or on a DVD that maybe you're going to mail out to the right person who might see it or might not see it, or, you know, so how do you find that balance for your players, or do you even play that role with them of how to create a good persona? So not giving too much of yourself up, not giving too much of your privacy up, but, you know, you're dealing with 15-year-olds, 14-year-olds. How do you teach them that responsibility or to find that balance so that they're not already ruining their image before they get anywhere? Does that make sense? Like, do you know what I mean?
100%. That makes sense every single day of what we do at the Athlete Institute. So that question is, you know, more than current and more than relevant. And it's a great question. And for us, you know, we've been trying to get the positive aspects of what it can really do for a player and a person, but understanding that it has the ability to really have a negative side effect and a negative, you know, attention to a lot of people's lives, you know, living on social media and what it, you know, the hype of that you have to and do this and do that. But, you know, with every positive, there comes, you know, a lot of pitfalls that these kids, these athletes can fall into with what they post, with, you know, the time that is just spent staring at their phone. So for us at Orangeville Prep, you know, at 8 a.m. when they go to school, they all have place cards where they've got their names on them. And every day, you know, they lay their phone on there. And from 8 to 8, you know, their phone sits on that spot. And that's when they're, you know, they really get the work in. And they really sort of dive down, so there's no distraction in their, you know, their strength training or their individual skill work or their team practices. It's not just 5 minutes here and 5 minutes there, because that really adds up throughout the day and how much time you're not actually spending getting better. And so we look at that. So, you know, for our athletes, their phones are, you know, unless they've proven that, you know, with grades and responsibility and leadership that they are able to have their phone with them throughout the day, you know, their phones are confiscated to the coaches and they're sat there on the site. But on the flip side, part of our curriculum that we teach at the Athlete Institute is on, you know, the business of sports, how to capitalize on your social capital, right? Because social capital and social equity for these athletes is a massive undertaking, especially with name, image, and likeness. So we're teaching our players now, you know, really how to build their brand so that when they are able to take advantage of it, you know, whether that be in college, if they become a big star on name, image, and likeness, whether they just understand what people are looking for in that sort of social equity, social capital space, using their brand, their positive brand that they've built, and allowing it to work with them rather than work against them. And so our athletes will go through collective bargaining agreements. They go through shareholder agreements for, you know, the business of sports. They go through player contracts. You know, they're doing this business of sports curriculum while they're here doing their, you know, their regular Ontario curriculum as well.
That's impressive because, you know, at that age, and a lot of times the guys that are making it to the pro level, whether that's the NBA or a respective league overseas, at 19, 20, you know, some of these guys even 18, they have no idea this machine of the business world in the sports space. And they know how to play basketball, but oftentimes they get taken advantage of. There's people that they allow into their circle that doesn't necessarily have their personal best interests in mind. They have their own. And you see a lot of these athletes get exploited because they don't know any better.
It's sad. It started from the very beginning. And that's one of the, you know, the main points of why I started the academy is because I saw this, you know, wave of kids, 13, 14, 15, 16, leaving to go to American high schools or prep schools or pop-ups or whatever it might be. And, you know, for every one that worked out, you know, there was four that were left with, you know, whether it be credits that don't count to, you know, years that are lost to, you know, just a lot of debt, you know, created because, you know, parents do anything they can if it's for the hopes of, you know, getting them a post-secondary or post-secondary scholarship. So parents will definitely go do what they can, but a lot of times that, you know, what's left is it didn't work out and here's what you're left with. So seeing that, I really saw an opportunity to, one, Canada's got the talent, you know, they've got the talent, they've got, you know, the drive, they've got that sort of underdog mentality, which is huge when it comes to, if you just look at business itself, if you got a whole industry of underdogs, you know, you bet on those ones when it comes to people who are hungry to build a business. And if you just look at it the same way, we've got this whole generation of underdogs as far as athletes in Canada who are hungry. And if we know that they're hungry and they want it and they've got, you know, the talent, the size, the analytics to make sense, all we got to do is provide them access to resources because they'll take it from there. And that's what we've seen. And that's what we've, you know, what we've tried to do at Orangeville Prep.
We shoot this, we're located on the East Coast in Nova Scotia. So the concept of basketball prep programs is in its infancy over here. We have only two, I believe, between New Brunswick and ourselves. And they're just starting out. So the Institute is connected to Orangeville Prep. What was the process to get that started and to make that connection? And what were some like the three smartest things that you did to grow this academy?
Three smartest things was I didn't sacrifice the athlete for results. So, you know, everybody, you know, they need wins, they need results, you know, to prove that they've got a good academy. To me, one, I didn't sacrifice any athlete because of it. You know, for us, it's about individual pathways. And because we don't want this to be the best team that they ever play for. We don't want this to be the end of their hopes and dreams and goals. This is supposed to give them a better shot continuing their pathway. So making sure that every kid has its own pathway, whether it's youth sports, NCAA, straight to the NBA, you know, stopping basketball and focusing on a school or whatever it is, we hope to help them find that pathway. So one, you know, we don't sacrifice the individual for the, you know, for the greater goal. Two, it was focusing on all the aspects that are not necessarily on the court. So making sure that they're, you know, they've got access to strength conditioning and prehab and rehab and mental health if they need it. You know, mental health is a huge wave, which is just going to keep growing in this country and around the world, you know, one because of social media, other because of just massive pressures now in all the industries getting younger and younger. So for us, we need to make sure that their mental space is just as ready, just as developed as their physical. And if we don't, then we haven't created much, we haven't helped much. So, you know, making sure that that whole athlete, you know, gets taken care of and it's not just about basketball. And then three, it's just hiring the right people who truly care. So, you know, there's a lot of people who, you know, see the appeal, see the, you know, they love the game, they love what's possible. But when it comes down to it, one, we're dealing with children who are at the most impressionable times of their life between the ages of 13 and 18. We have a real responsibility to make sure that the people that are in their lives, you know, truly, truly care about their full development. And then we have a responsibility to make sure that those athletes are looked at as a whole. And it's not just basketball, 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 but making sure that the little things get looked at. And then, you know, our other point is we care about the individual pathway more than it would be the team success or their, you know, wins loss category. So
those are all really good takeaways. Those are the three. I'm a counselor and I used to work with high school students. So when I hear of a program like yours that really puts the emphasis on the mental health of the students, it shows, and we talk about that more. We talk about this on the show. We talk about this with the NBA. I think we used to call it the psychological game, and there are aspects to it that is still the psychology of the game, but understanding that it's so much more than that. And especially with kids, the age group that you're dealing with and the issues and the pressures of adolescence that already exist for a normal kid, let alone one who's on the path to potentially sports stardom.
It's overwhelming.
Right? It's all overwhelming. And so I think that the more programs like yours and the more people in various aspects of teenagers' lives that realize mental health is not mental illness. Mental health is something that we all have. And we all need to keep it in check the same way that you're going to condition off of the court, the same way that you're going to run drills on the court. You have to run drills and do exercises that maintain an individual's mental health as well. It's like it's part of the whole package. I think we're on 100% the right path.
And the same. Yeah, absolutely. We're on the right path. I still think there's a lot of work and acceptance to be done in that path, because you look at the first, you know, we're only recently in the athletic world, and at the highest level, starting to understand, okay, well, there's more to training than just, you know, lifting weights. But there's this whole aspect of got to take care of your body. You look at and you see guys like LeBron saying, I'm spending $1.5 million on my body a year. Well, that's not just to lift weights, right?
Yeah.
You know, we're looking at the top level, him looking to take care of his mental health means whether that's a coach, whether that's mentors, like, there's a whole aspect of mental health to add on your, you know, exact sentiment of it's not a problem thing. It's an awareness and training thing. And our society is going quicker than what's able to catch up. So we're seeing where the gaps are for the problems. So we're seeing these gaps, but they're not the problems. It's just, we don't have a resource center to help it. And so for us, making sure, and we don't do everything perfect, but we understand that we have a responsibility before the athletes do to make sure that we're telling them that this is a need and it's not just, you know, a problem fix, because our healthcare system in you got a problem, here's how to fix it. It doesn't work, and it's never worked for athletes. And that's why they're as good as they are and they can, you know, push and push and push on their bodies. But in the same sense, our industry needs to catch up with the mental health and mental training of our athletes and support, because I had this conversation the other day, you know, with a friend, just, hey, when we were in high school or out of high school, how would we have even communicated? Did I phone you and say, hey, what's going on?
Yeah, you picked up the house phone and you called their house phone.
How are you?
And you asked their parents if they were home. That's what we did.
And so I think about all the missing steps of what could have triggered somebody or had a negative impact along those ways that our kids have now.
Yeah.
And you just have to have empathy. So understanding.
Okay. We're not going to talk too much longer about this. I could talk about it all day long, but then, you know, our listeners will tune out. But the bottom line is prevention. And what you're doing is prevention. It's mental health prevention. You're addressing something. And we have a healthcare system that's wonderful and I'm thankful for it, but it's reactionary. So it waits for a problem and then it reacts to that problem. So the more, again, going back to people like yourself, programs that you run, anybody who's working with our adolescents in whatever capacity it is, when you do mental health prevention, it helps offset what's lacking in an already overstressed healthcare system. And
overstressed,
and hopefully it like mitigates problems before they manifest into something else. Because most of the time, kids just need to know how to process their feelings and need to have people to be able to trust to talk to about them. And it doesn't have to become a big deal.
Very true.
Right? Anyway, sorry. Okay.
And for us, last point on that, because I could talk on it all day too. It's just that, you know, we understand that we are leaders in this industry. Our athletes understand that they're looked upon as leaders in this industry. So for us to make it commonplace or common action to work on your headspace, to work on your mindfulness, to work on those things, you know, we were really believe and know that there'll be a trickle down effect.
That's right.
Because if our guys are doing it, it'll be more accepted for the next class and other people who are looking on. Yeah. So, you know, we have a responsibility, not just for our athletes, but to send that message that, you know, this is something that we need to start looking at from a preventative space rather than a reactionary
space.
Absolutely.
Love that.
Jesse, when you set out to execute this vision, who did you model it off? You know, there's not many programs in Canada that have done this successfully. There's a lot of barriers that people have faced. Maybe it's both financially or both from a capability standpoint. So when you set out to execute, were there some model examples that you said, okay, they've done it really well abroad. How can we do it here?
There absolutely has. I mean, nobody reinvents the wheel. They take pieces and they make it round, you know, and it's a different size wheel or whatever it is. So, you know, when I did my exploration of having an end goal of what I wanted to create, you know, this academy that really fuels and helps kids execute, you know, their ability to achieve their dreams. You know, I looked at the other people out there who might be doing something similar. So, you know, on the professionalism side of training, of medical care, of all those different pieces, I looked at an IMG Academy, which I had a lot of experience with. And my siblings went there in their basketball academy for high school, my younger siblings. And so I saw them go through the process of the academy. I trained there as an athlete post university, trying to get ready to, you know, continue playing. So I got their sort of professional development firsthand. And then I trained with them as when I became a strength coach, did certifications, did sort of intern training and stuff like that at IMG. So I'm very familiar, and I took them as an example of, you know, leaders in professionalism, right? Everything they do is to a professional grade. But then I also saw some of the downfalls and what else is needed in the academy. So I looked at a St. Andrew's College on the sort of historical culture and buy-in of what they can have their athletes, because they can have all the professionalism you want, but if you don't have, you know, this true buy-in from your current class of that it's, you're there for a reason, you have lineage, you have other people who are, you know, showing, you know, having your back or have done it before. And that's what a St. Andrew's and private schools really do, is they say, other people have been in your position before. So here, the, you know, it's possible, and here are the things that they sort of grabbed onto, and whether that's Academy Awards or, you know, always telling our history and lineage. So that's something I grabbed onto there. And then on the other side, you look at like an Oak Hill. So I use them as an example because, you know, they've had this level of consistency, right? And that they hold themselves to a professional standard of consistency, and they go for the best players year in, year out. And they get some each year, they don't get others another year, but they hold themselves as the highest standard of, we're not going to dictate personalities and what they are to our program, but we know that we're going to hold ourselves to our own standards and we're going to be consistent about it. So those are sort of the three that I would say in terms of, you know, where I modeled and where I sort of saw and saw reference to. I saw those three as, you know,
well,
where I went.
We, you know, we have a little bit of commonality in the fact that, you know, your siblings went to IMG, you trained there. I went to IMG, and that's how we inevitably got connected. So when you take all of those three examples, and I mean, they're all excellent examples, once you executed and launched, what was the breakthrough moment for you guys where it finally, all the hard work started to, you know, not maybe the wrong word term is boil over, but the tipping point?
The point,
no,
the tipping point. Yeah, no pun intended. Yeah. But
I think we
I would
just gave him the answer to one of the questions we're going to ask him later. Sorry.
The tipping point, you know, I would say when I realized that we had a much larger responsibility than firsthand anticipating was, you know, 2016 draft. So when I saw two of our athletes, you know, go as lottery picks in the draft, and I was there to experience it and seeing the magnitude of what was possible from a small town of Orangeville and what we're, you know, had been doing up until that point. You know, I started off with, I want to get X amount of Division I athletes by this year. If we can do that, you know, we've got sort of proof of concept that it's needed. And, you know, we shattered that within the second year of even doing it. And it showed me that there are so many talented kids out there and the numbers are there. And that's when sort of, and then the draft kind of put it over the top. That was saying, okay, we're on to something. This can be really, you know, bigger than even anticipated. So let's really look at making sure that, you know, we're able to grow and, you know, we're going to continue to grow with the rising talent pool in Canada. So that'd be the sort of the one. I mean, that's a clear, obvious,
of course, you
know, people get drafted, like that's, but it was a real eye opener too, because leading up to that, it was, this could happen. This could happen. These guys could do this. These guys do that. And then they did it. Right. And then it happened, you know, Thon being the
let me stop you
going from a Canadian. Yeah, absolutely.
I'll stop you there. So were you at Barclays in 2016 for the draft?
I was, yeah. I was sitting with Thon and his family in camp. Yeah.
So you've got Jamal that goes 7th, Thon goes 10th. If you can just walk us through the day you woke up of draft night to the time you went to bed, what was that day like?
A little surreal. Definitely a little surreal. It's, you know, I got the invite late and I, you know, I'm always in a supportive role, but not, I try not to be in a need role with our players and our alumni. So, you know, if they were set up and they were ready, but I got the call, you know, probably 2 days before the draft from Thon and his camp just saying, hey, we'd really like you to be here. So, you know, I was like, all right, here we go. So, you know, we had a whole draft party set up for our gym with the, you know, big live stream and the whole town sort of there to cheer it on, which was great. But being there, and because Thon wasn't invited to the green room, right, which is on the floor of draft day. So he's sitting up in the stands. So I'm sitting down with the stands as well. And nobody sort of anticipated him going 10th. So when I'm sitting there and all of a sudden you see all these boom, like camera booms and mic booms, just like, you know, all these robot cameras like shifting and all focusing on like where we're sitting. I was like, it's real. And so that day of, I think I flew in that day of the draft to, you know, fly in, get there, you know, see the draft, go through that, and then, you know, go through the draft party with, you know, we had a draft party with Jamal and Thon in the city and that. So people were messing with people, telling people that I was Miles Plumlee, like walking through New York City, and everybody's like buying this, like, it's Miles Plumlee, like, this is good, you know.
Well, congratulations to that, man. What an achievement.
Oh, I appreciate it. It's still surreal. Honestly, it's still surreal.
And, you know, last year you tied Oak Hill for the number of graduates that you had that went into the NBA. And Oak Hill is undoubtedly considered the greatest basketball
alum from there.
Program. And now here you are, this Canadian counterpoint that is matching them and is elevating them. And you yourself, Jesse, so when we talk about Canada basketball and who has catapulted Canada basketball, you think Steve Nash. More recently, I think Masai. I think there's, and your name is there. You are a part of that conversation. I don't want to ask you the obvious of how does that make you feel, but you know, what does that mean to you, or what, you know, how do you fulfill that, or how do you feel you have fulfilled that?
I think the pieces that I've, you know, helped put together in an already sort of very hungry community of basketball in Canada, to me, it's an us, you know, we've put it together. I try to feel like I represent sort of the basketball content that wasn't there prior. And, you know, the fact that my name is at the top of that list as sort of the catalyst, it makes me really proud, you know, very proud. Always been sort of a proud member of Canada and Canada basketball and what could be. And so, you know, I'm immense pride that, you know, my name is sort of sometimes resonating with some of those leaders. But, you know, there's a lot of people who have sort of helped me get to this point, whether it be our team or players or coaches. So, you know, I just am really thankful that, one, Canada, we were born into a country, we're able to do business in a country that's, you know, even if it doesn't support it, allows you to do it, right? Because Canada's, especially in sports, have always been a market where you prove it down south and then we give you credit for it up north. And, you know, it drives me nuts because even with Jamal, like, we've been singing his praises since day one on how good he could possibly be. He got all the accolades, and then still it's, you guys see the bubble? Didn't know he was that good. It's like, okay, well, like, we clearly saw it coming, but, you know, I think just my ability to see the holes that could be filled in our community and our landscape of basketball, and then having the resources and the, I guess, the guts to try, you know, I'm very proud to be up there. I don't think I, you know, have scratched the surface yet, honestly, of what, you know, we have planned and we want to do, but I think we're capable of so much more here in Canada. And I just hope to always be at the front lines of pushing what is possible.
So when you pair your efforts and Canada as a whole, Toronto Raptors winning the 2019 championship, you've really seen a shift in this country. Hockey has been at the forefront for a very long time, but in the last 10, I'd say 10 years, you've really seen that shift. I can sum of it up to the shift in immigration. We've got so many more people arriving in this country, and basketball is a sport that's very accessible. You pair that with more and more people playing and having success and a Raptors championship and programs like yours, we've now seen this rise where we can't be overlooked. And I really think the amount of athletes that we have in the NBA now who are Canadians is a testament to that hard work. So with all of that said, as far as on the global scale, when we think of the Olympics coming up in, you know, in Tokyo for 2021, do you expect to see a lot of these Canadians who are in the NBA playing for our country?
Yeah, I hope they do. Again, like, it's hard to say what athletes should do, right? Because we're living in a world where everybody is their brand. You know, it's a player is representing who he is as a company now, right? So if playing for Canada doesn't impact his earning ability, his, you know, what, you know, could be or should be, I think they all want to play and they all want to represent their country and they're proud of it. But I think every life scenario is different. And I think to say that every player should drop that just because, you know, they get to put Canada on their chest is tough. We're producing these players. We have more players in the NBA now than ever. But that is still, you know, the NBA is skewing younger and it's skewing towards more development. So it doesn't necessarily mean everybody's ready to play and it's the best interest for them to go play and put that into that. So I think you're getting a snowball effect of players like Jamal and Dylan Brooks and these guys who are saying, we will be playing for our country. But that's because they've been able to solidify themselves in their self and in the NBA so that it really makes sense for them now and they can take that next step. It takes a while to be sort of ready. And international competition is no joke. So just because they're in the NBA, you know, it doesn't mean that the rest of the players around the league are at, of lesser value. Like, these teams and countries are playing together for months and years at a time. And the leagues that they're playing in are, you know, very, very strong leagues that more compared to the FIBA game than players who are playing the NBA. So when it goes to them playing an international competition and you've got internationals who aren't in the NBA but been playing in, you know, in their high-level pro leagues, it's tough. So it's not a guarantee, you know, success just because we got the second amount of NBA players. But I think you're definitely going to see, with the maturity of some of our NBA players, you know, getting to a little bit older and having sort of a better foundation, yeah, we're definitely going to see more players sort of putting on that jersey. And hopefully we get, you know, set results. But, you know, to your point, I think it's going to continue. Our immigration policy is very, you know, pro countries that really love basketball. So you're getting all of those new friendlies into our country that you know, really help with the bottom level growth and potential. And you've got sort of an open marketplace. I think where we're really going to starting to see the need in Canada is, you know, private infrastructure, private companies really looking to, you know, look at this sport. You've got sort of all of these markers in basketball that say, okay, the next step is really, you know, private and corporate. So, you know, corporations looking to see it as, you know, things that they want to market around. And then privately, you're going to start seeing sort of more facilities and programs that, you know, start to herd some of these masses into the need. Because the only reason that my facility exists is because there was a teacher and a janitorial strike in the year 2000, which basically prohibited kids from playing. They lost gyms because janitors wouldn't open the gym, and they lost gyms and teams because teachers went to work to rule. So the only reason that I'm here and able to do it is because at that time, you know, we said we need a private facility that is not dictated by what the school boards and what the government says needs to happen for kids to play. And now everything's shut down, so except us.
So let's go back to that, because that pioneer story, that beginning story, leads us to the fun connection to one of my favorite shows. So you didn't want to have the limitations of a school system or of, you know, you wanted to be a private entity. So where did that start? What was the first piece to that puzzle?
The first piece is probably my upbringing, right? Seeing, you know, parents, grandparents who say, when there isn't a road, you make a road. And when there is an opportunity, or there is, you know, you see something that's wrong or something that could be better, you fix it, and you put in the work and you fix it. So that, you know, private pioneer aspect, you know, and it really started in our original building, which was built by my mother and father in 1999, when they had these strikes. They said, you know, I don't know if you guys allow cursing on your show, but I won't do it, but
you can do it.
You know, it was, you know, this is horseshit. Kids need to be able to play, and it shouldn't be dictated on the school board or the government saying that we'll open our facilities. Kids need a safe place, and they need a place to always be able to just play. And so that's why they built, you know, our original field house building, and it acted as a community center for at all times. Everybody, I hear now stories of people coming back and say, I was there when I was 13. It meant so much to me. It was a tough time in my life. Whatever it might be, it acted exactly as needed. And that was a safe place that kids could always come play.
And then where did you go from there? You know where from I want there. You to go. Come on. Yeah.
So when starting the basketball academy, we knew that in order to do it right, the kids needed a safe place to live that had, you know, quarters and housing for coaches to be able to still be adults and still be coaches. So there was a motel that was available to buy at the time, conveniently. I bought that motel, turned it into dormitories for all of our athletes. And then the next year I got a call from, you know, a fun little show called Schitt's Creek that said, hey, would you be willing to rent us your motel so that we can use it for our show? And at the time, you know, they said it's going to be on CBC. It's called Schitt's Creek. I said, is that even allowed?
When it's spelled the way it was spelled, yeah. It's fine.
And they said, oh, well, and they had Eugene Levy involved and Dan Levy and Catherine O'Hare. I said, okay, well, they'll probably, you know, be able to get the Schitt's Creek stuff passed through. And we signed an agreement, and they were amazing to work with. So for 6 years, you know, every year the cast would come in. We would have to displace our athletes, and they would set them up in, you know, in the Best Western, a nice hotel for a whole month. And so then the cast would come in, do all their filming. And, it was, you know, at the beginning, it was the cast sort of walking around being like, who are these kids who are like so huge, like in the middle of Hockley Village?
Did they
like,
make cameos?
Like, yeah. Did they get on any of the episodes?
They didn't know. No. They didn't get on the episodes, but you know, there's video and interviews of, you know, some of the staff being like, yeah, there's basketball kids walking around. And, you know, and so it's been interesting now because they've looped back a little bit to be like, who was it that was there that's now in the NBA? Because they have an interest to know.
Right.
And then the same side, you know, it's like this show Schitt's Creek has, you know, built this massive following and they've won all these awards, rightfully so. Now you got these basketball players saying that was the show that was like, you know, there during our time. So it's these two great pieces of, you know, Canadiana to me that is just perfectly harmonized in the sense that I needed a motel to put, you know, these basketball players in the middle of the country in Hockley Village, and Eugene and Dan Levy needed a motel as well, right, in the middle of,
it's, know, crazy.
Nowhere. It's so, yeah, so it's so perfect. And it makes you our perfect guest, which is what I said or I alluded to in our intro, because we are not just a basketball show. We like to talk about pop culture and world events and other issues as they relate and intertwine with the basketball world. And I know that Jamal Murray should be the name that excites me the most when I'm thinking about talking to you. But really, Catherine O'Hara and Eugene Levy are the ones that really do it for me.
Oh, man, they're incredible people. And, like, they're so funny. They're so incredible. And honestly, they treated everybody with, like, the highest levels of respect the whole time, which was amazing. It's so...
You know, where did Rosebud come from?
Yeah, did you name it Rosebud or did they name it Rosebud?
No, they did, yeah. And so even the sign that's there, right, and people think, you know, still to this day, there's 50 to 100 cars an hour, like every day, rolling in to try to take a picture. You know, they don't care that it's private property or anything like that. Like, they want their picture and they're getting their picture. So when they changed it to Rosebud and they had to change the motel sign, it was like a hush hush, like, you know, try not to, you know, let people take pictures and stuff like that during that time. So,
wow.
So cool.
Honestly, it's been a wild ride. And especially since they won the Grammys, like, I needed my own PR team with the amount of like TV interviews and radio interviews. And
they swept, you know, swept the Emmys. I think they were up for five and they got all five of them. It's a shame that it was a COVID socially isolated Emmys show this year, but the honor is absolutely still the honor.
But I think the best piece that nobody really knows about Schitt's Creek and us, and I'm not sure if you know, but we have our own TV show coming out January 15th.
Yep, Anyone's Game.
Anyone's Game, yeah. And I have always been working with a friend on the production side to getting this show built and filmed and executed on and stuff like that. So he's been, you know, I've known him for years. He's been in the industry. And so I was always working with him to get this show up. And then he had no idea that I owned the Rosebud Motel, that they did that. And then when Schitt's Creek won all their Emmys, he was the first person that Eugene and Dan thanked on stage.
Wow.
And so he phoned me and said, I didn't. And then I saw the clip and I said, I didn't know you had anything to do with Schitt's Creek. He's like, oh yeah, like they're good friends and I helped start the show.
Wow.
And I said, do you know I own the motel? And he's like, no. And so
I love
it's
Canada.
Had the same sort of underlying like support system and sense that he saw Schitt's Creek as a show, a Canadian show that needed to happen. And he saw our show as well as a show that needed to happen and another great story. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, our show comes out January 15th on CBC and CBC Gem, you know, and it's absolutely going to, you know, it's going to be a game changer for, you know, a lot of things, right? One, it's great content. It's an amazing show and it's got a lot of sort of ups and downs within it. But two, we don't have to think of ourselves as constantly second to the U.S., whether that's in, you know, the media industry, in the sports industry, in anything. If Schitt's Creek has showed us anything, it's you can be number one coming from our side. If our program has shown anything, you can be number one coming from our side.
Yeah.
So there's no excuses for us to not go for the top of everything, being in Canada and being Canadian. So
I agree completely. And you know, I'm looking forward to watching the documentary, but there's a piece to it as well that I loved that I read about that you featured only up and coming musicians for the soundtrack. And I just, you know, think that that's brilliant and I can't wait. Lunchroom Poets, I'm pretty sure that they're featured. They're awesome and I'm going to be excited. And again, because music is another area that we don't need to. We are our own class. We do yeah. it quite well up here. We don't need to be our neighbors to the south to succeed. And anyway, I just give you a shout out for that.
Like, we don't give ourselves enough credit for all those things. So when we did this show and we have the ability, and my thing is like, if we're going to continue to rise, let's bring all the ships up, right? Like, let's make sure that we're supporting our own. Let's make sure that we're putting a light on the positive aspects of all the things that people are doing in Canada.
Yeah.
So it was a guarantee, like, yeah, let's make sure that we've got up and comers, you know, the urban, you know, urban core of, you know, what is basketball, what is sports and hip hop and culture. And again, that goes way over my head. Like, I wouldn't be the one picking those songs and stuff like that, but I'm just happy that, you know, the whole team knew that that was important. Right. And that was key. And the soundtrack is unreal.
I'm excited. I'm excited.
Yep. Yeah. It's on the calendar. We've got it marked down and we're looking forward to it. So a question I have for you, when it comes to the game of basketball and to Trisha's point earlier, you know, pop culture, world events, we tie it all together. We also have a pretty strong female following with the WNBA. So, you know, we've had Kia Nurse on the show. We just had Bria Hartley on, and we've got, you know, Jordan Canada from Seattle coming on within the next few weeks. So what do you think of what you've done now with the men's program? Is that the next step? You know, if you are a young girl in Canada and you want to play basketball, is there a pathway?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, putting it out there now, some people know, some people don't. But September 2021, there'll be an Orange Bowl Prep women's team.
Yes.
And we will be going at, and the reason we haven't put it up till now, and that I've said this through and through, is I'm not putting a secondary product in there as the women's team, 100%. Right? Because I'm not gonna ready to do it until our girls don't feel like second-class citizens to the boys while they're there, and that it we're ready and able to. And so we didn't rush it. This, you know, coming up here, you know, Orange Bowl Prep will, you know, women's team will sort of set the foundation for going forward. But I think 100% women's sports, women in industry, we've been neglecting almost 50% of our talent pool. Like, can you just like imagine that, yeah. Right? If we actually, you know, give that side, you know, a fair shake, like we're just going to be that much better off, like honestly. And so, you know, when we did, when I started the OSBA, the Ontario Scholastic Basketball Association with the OBA, you know, which has now got 14 teams on the girls' side and 14 teams on the guys' side. And, you know, it's the top league in Canada and one of the top leagues in North America. Our mandate was, okay, year one, we're starting with guys, but by year two, we have to have a girls' pathway. And I think more than ever, girls are still don't have all the access and ability and resources that the guys do. I think that's quickly going to change though. And again, you see the change when the top wants it to change. And the top being, you know, like you've got all these NBA players now. And when they say, it's, you know, they need support and you need to support, you see a lot more people, you know, buying in that it's cool, you know, wear an orange hoodie. Like, it's as simple as that to like spread the love all the way down. And so I think we're going to start to see a lot bigger endorsement contracts for women than we are for men, because they hold a voice that's stronger to an audience in a lot of times. And then the contract will start to come up as well, because there's a huge gap and the numbers, you know, need to reflect that we need to support this side. And so for us, Orange Bowl Prep, you know, 2021 will be our inaugural women's team. You know, we're very excited. We are on the hunt right now for the coach to spearhead that. And, you know, we're going to make sure that we have the best person for that job. And, you know, I think absolutely as soon as we include all sides and giving them a voice, you know, we're just better off.
Well,
and so we need more voices, and we need more attention to detail on that side.
We're gonna have to get UConn's very own Coach Oriyama up here to Canada and to Orangeville Prep to see some of these ladies play.
Absolutely.
I love where the WNBA is going. You know, I love where women's sports is going. Shout out to, you know, the Gist, if you guys follow the Gist, but they're, you know, a great sports media, you know, page on Instagram and website and newsletter that is sort of women's sports and women's entertainment. And they're, you know, a fantastic platform to show the successes and the needs in women's sports. So
big time. Circling just back now to a guy like Jamal, who you feel as if, you know, he's this obviously coming out of the bubble, the battles there with Donovan Mitchell and the world kind of having the aha moment of, okay, this guy's a superstar. He's accomplished so much, but he's still only 23 years old. When you have an interaction with him now, and if that is something that is still possible, I mean, post and alumni, what are some of the conversations that you have with him? What is at the top of his mind now moving forward at this stage of his career? Because he's still so young.
Exactly what was on the top of his mind when he was with us, you know, in 2015, 2013, 14, and 15. And that's become the best basketball player in the world. But he wants to do it based on internally. He wants to be the best that Jamal can be. And he's always held this, and he gets it from, you know, his parents and you know, Roger's always one to really put the perspective of why he does it. And it's, you know, he's a very unique kid in the sense that he just wants to keep getting better and better and better and better because he knows he can. And it's not to be better than somebody, or whether it's to be better than, you know, Mitchell or Steph or anybody. He just wants the most out of Jamal. And I think that if more kids had that, you know, we would see more Jamals because it's in there. You just have to believe in yourself. And he really believes in himself. He's got a good support system that way. But honestly, like, you know, 2 weeks ago I talked to him and it was the exact same thing. I want to just keep getting better, you know. And I said when he got drafted, he'll be the MVP by his sixth year.
Okay.
And I still think so.
Okay. You're on record now.
That's fine. I was on record then too. It's just all my predictions just get a little closer to reality when you're betting on such talented kids. So
absolutely. Jesse, we like to close off each show with three fun questions that we ask everybody. Not basketball related, not really, at least. And I don't want you to think too hard, just what the first thing that comes to mind.
Sure.
Okay. So the first one is, and I think we already did it for you halfway through the show, but if you were to write your autobiography today, what would you call it?
It's Just a Game.
Oh, good. I thought you were going to go for the tipping point, but it's Just a Game.
That's already true.
I was going to say, I'm pretty sure that's already a book title. It's Just a Game. All right. And who would you get to play you in the movie?
Oh, geez.
I know who I would get you to play you in the movie, but let's see what your answer is.
I don't know a lot of names of people, but I would say...
You can think of it.
I guess selfishly, Bradley Cooper.
Oh, Brad there Cooper. There we go. That's a good answer. That was not my answer, but that makes sense. I went darker. I went Jeremy Renner. So I don't know if you know Hawkeye from the Avengers, but that's where I went for
okay.
you. Yeah, no.
Yeah, I'll take it.
But
take
Bradley
that too,
Cooper,
yeah.
too. No, Bradley Cooper, too. I get it. Oh, now I forgot. Now I'm thinking about Bradley Cooper and Jeremy Renner.
I know, right? Sorry. Now I'm thinking about Bradley Cooper.
All right. And if there's any TV show, current or in the past, that most resembles your life, which one would it be?
Oh, that's an interesting one.
You can't pick the documentary that's coming out on your life next on January 15th.
Yeah. Arrested Development, I would say.
Wow, good answer. Oh, that's always my favorite question, honestly. That's a very, very good question.
I resonate with Michael.
With Michael.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
thank you.
Jesse, it's been a pleasure. Once we're post-pandemic and, you know, we can travel freely across the country, we're still out here out east, there's still some provincial lockdowns. We can't wait to make our way up to Orangeville, check out the facilities, and more importantly, meet you. So we appreciate having you on.
I appreciate being on, but I really appreciate what you guys are doing. You know, just having a voice and trying something and sticking to it and really giving it a go. Like, it's, you know, we need more of you two. We need more of people who see that there's laneways in sports and media, that as long as you really go for it, you know, you're capable of it and you're able to get it done. So kudos to you guys. The show's incredible. Thank you so much for having me on, and continue doing what you're doing, because as a country, we'll just keep moving forward.
Thanks so much.
Let's keep winning.
And we're going to have you, and we want to have you back in Halifax once life goes back to normal, and we can just get on a plane and come here and hang out on the
love
waterfront.
Halifax.
So love anytime awesome. You're open invitation anytime you want.
Wonderful. If you guys are ever in Orangeville, there's a small little basketball academy that I'd love for you.
Check it out. Sounds good. Yeah.
Thanks for tuning in. Join Trish and I every week as we welcome the stars and personnel from the league we love, the NBA. Listen and subscribe for free wherever you find your podcasts.